Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be talking about an event that takes place throughout the country that has become very popular. And those of you that listen to me regularly know that this event is coming up in August here in the state of Washington, and it's called a Renaissance Fair. Well, to my amazement, a few months back, I found out that a company had put together a documentary on the Renaissance Fair, how this festival began, and it was really well done and very, very informative. So we have one of the people that put this production together, Doug Jacobson. And Doug, I want to welcome you to the show, first of all.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
You've won all kinds of awards with this movie.
We have played in some film festivals and met a lot of people all over the country who are involved in the Renaissance Fair. It's absolutely huge.
It really is. How many Renaissance Fairs are going on in the country? Do you have any idea?
We think that, they think there's about a couple hundred. And there's a lot of small fairs. There's not a lot of huge fairs anymore, probably like 20 or 30 of those. But there's a ton of small Renaissance fairs. And the documentary tends to focus a little bit on like sort of the birth of the sort of California fair. And then later on it explains how it spread all over the country. Now you go to the fair too, right?
Yes. In fact, I've participated in the Washington Renaissance Fair up here, and now it's up in Buckley, but it has just grown through the years, and it is huge today, not as big as I think some of them in California and in Colorado, but we're getting there, and it's amazing. We'll have up to 80,000 people turn out over 3 weekends, and it's growing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just incredible, the turnout that we have had here in the state of Washington. People just love it. Let's go into the history, because you did such a marvelous job of explaining how one woman originated this. Now, first of all, let's go with a word, and you have this right in the very beginning of your film, counterculture. What was that meaning at the time when the brainstorm about the Renaissance Fair evolved? What does that mean?
Well, I was trying to find out the origin of the word counterculture, and I think it's fair to say that there's always been some kind of counterculture existing in every culture, you know, like, the beatniks, and, been all sorts of kind of counterculture going on. But the actual term counterculture was somehow born around the mid-60s, and around the same time that the Renaissance Fair came about. It was a KPFK fundraiser, and for those of you that don't know, KPFK is a public radio station down here in Los Angeles. And they teamed up with this woman, Phyllis and Ron Patterson, and they created this event to help raise money for the radio station. And I was saying in the documentary, because I had been involved with countercultures other than the fair, and so I was making the case in the documentary that the fair legitimately could be one of the first countercultures using the term. There are others around the time as well, but the fair was a counterculture. It was a reaction to all the stuff going on in the late 60s. You're going into a sort of a fantasy world. Creating a holodeck, actually, you know. I love people who create holodecks, to use a Star Trek term. A fully immersive environment where everybody you can walk up to will fully understand, fully has studied history and created their character to the point where you can carry on a conversation with them. I mean, that's pretty intense.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So she started... Yeah, I was just going to say, she started the fair, and then they broke up around 67, the KPFK and the Pattersons broke up, and that could be a whole documentary in itself, which we didn't have time to get into in the documentary, but she took it on, and it kept going, until today. There's a lineage of that very fair owned by a company, but still from the same lineage, the Southern California Pleasure Fair.
Now, you have a very well-known actress, and she plays in a very significant film. Her name is Cameron Manheim, and when I saw her face in this documentary, I had to chuckle. Because here is a woman who plays a significant role in Ghost Whisperer, and
right.
which is a very, very popular show. And she started in this. She was just a young squirt when this started up.
Mm-hmm.
And she absolutely loves it because she said getting involved in the Renaissance was like just going into, using your words again, a fantasy experience, and she talks about the wonderful people that were involved. Let's backpedal, though, a little bit. Let's talk about Phyllis, because Phyllis was an entrepreneur. She really was someone that dared to do something so uniquely different, and am I correct, did this start out in Agoura, California? And for those that are listening in different parts of the country, tell us where Agoura is and what its environment is like.
Well, I will say that the first Renaissance fairs they did in the first few years was not in Agoura. It was around L.A.
Oh, okay.
At a school and some other places. So, however, in, I think, 67, it landed in Agoura. And I'll tell you where Agoura is. It's basically, Agoura Hills is a suburb of Los Angeles. I don't know how to describe this to people, but let me put it this way. Agoura Hills is around some other suburbs of L.A., on the other side of the hill from Malibu. So if you're in Malibu and you go over the mountain, you're going to land in Agoura Hills. It was also pretty close to, you know, L.A. proper, where Hollywood and all these people were. Mm-hmm. So what you had was a relatively creative and wealthy group of people who all, you know, within 20-minute drive, could be at this Renaissance fair. And I think that the proximity to those people in the early days helped fuel it. And if you see the documentary, you'll see that, you know, Martin Sheen, who went to the fair with his family, and, you know, we heard stories of Cher going and buying clothes at the fair. I guess if you think about Cher, it makes sense that she would go buy clothes at the Renaissance fair, considering her outfits. I mean, I was like, of course she bought clothes at the fair in the 70s. You know, Bob Dylan, you know, just insane amounts of famous people would go to the Renaissance Fair and party. And for all intents and purposes, we call the first fair being in Agoura, because the first few years it wasn't in Agoura, but it landed there, and it was there for years and years and years and years until 89. So I would say, let's call it from Agoura. And it's just a suburb of L.A. L.A.
Now,
has a zillion suburbs.
Yeah. Now, when you landed in Agoura, then Agoura is like these rolling hills, and
yeah.
It's very open. So what I liked about the film, which I have seen happen with the Renaissance Fair here in the state of Washington, is that you have all of this land. Now, you had trees, but it's not flat, it's not a parking lot, and it really, Phyllis really wanted authenticity. Renaissance period. What was that period? What is the time frame when we're talking about the Renaissance?
We're talking about the Renaissance Fair. They tried to recreate a period of Queen Elizabeth from maybe 1490s, mm-hmm. 1505, you know, somewhere in there. They really wanted to, they sort of zoomed it in on mostly Queen Elizabeth's life, because Queen Elizabeth was relatively liberal compared to her sister, who, you know, Bloody Mary,
mm-hmm.
who wasn't very, very well liked. So Queen Elizabeth was very much a Renaissance queen, and she was like, you know, trying to, you know, allow a little bit more religious freedoms and allow a little bit more creativity. And I think the echo that they were creating a Renaissance period fair in an American Renaissance period time, the late 60s, it's probably not lost on everybody. I mean, it was a Renaissance, it was a Renaissance in America, recreating a Renaissance in the, you know, sort of like 1490s, 1500s. So the period is around, let's just call it 1500, So you get a little bit of Shakespeare coming along later, you know, and things like that. So she did want authenticity, and there was a sort of a stickler for details and trying to get rid of watches and, you know, trying to maintain that. That's very difficult to do if you're throwing an event with tens of thousands of people. You're never going to squash out all the, the things.
The modern technologies that are available.
Yeah.
You're going to have ATM machines around today.
You're going to have the old ATM machine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The old credit card machine. So, and that's just inevitable. I think that they were able to maintain a level of quality, but I think that it, once it gets, you know, once people sort of copy the fair or do other fairs all over the country, they may not care as much about the history part of it, as much as sort of the theme park part of it. You know what I'm saying? Because there's a theme park element to it. You're going into a sort of a Disneyland world. But there's also the Renaissance Fair was a lot of historical society kind of focus. It was people had to create their own characters. They had to know the history of their character. They had to, you know, sort of walk around the fair playing that role of that character. People would spend their entire day walking around doing guerrilla theater and street theater, meaning they're not asking for money. They're not there getting, you know, necessarily paid very much by the fair, maybe some meal tickets and a little bit of money or free entry.
Mm-hmm.
But they were walking around, immersing people in the, doing little bits and going up to them and starting conversations and all sorts of things just to get people enrolled in the world, to let people know that they're in, you know, they're in another world. And that was key, having all those volunteers creating the atmosphere of the Renaissance Fair.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience that the ingenious designs that people will come up for costuming, and
Absolutely. Here
in the Northwest, they created the fantasy along with the Renaissance. Now, you have the Royal Court.
That's right.
And for those of you that have never attended a Renaissance fair, when you go in, there will be themes of all genre, and you have some phenomenal tradespeople. And in this movie, Fair, an American Renaissance, part of what is in this movie that makes it so special is that you are seeing something that was started many, many years ago, and you see the progression of the changes that had evolved through it. And, of course, people would always be brainstorming. But it was fascinating because you'd leave your modern-day world, and it happens today at any Ren Fair, and you enter into this magical environment where you have people on stilts that are dressed like jesters or particular characters, or you have tradespeople that are actually making things out on the ground. Now, this is something that you show in your film. You also show the outdoor theaters, which were historically very, very big.
They were big. It's interesting. They were the fair seems to have been, and I wasn't there in the 70s, but it seems to have been very much the Renaissance fair theme. What's happened now is it is more of a fantasy fair, or maybe they sort of loosened up the possibilities. You know, obviously, and I thought it was kind of an amusing thing, but obviously, you know, to the people who are trying to create a Renaissance fair, people want it to be, historically accurate. Having pirates there is just not, they're 200 years apart. So hundreds of years apart, so there's just not, it drives them crazy, you know, and I think that's kind of funny. But so I think the fairs today have loosened up, and they're not as much, they're more like a fantasy fair. You see people with, you know, angel wings, or, mm-hmm. you know, people from, and now they've started riffing on themes. You know, we did screening up at the Viking Festival. It's great. There's a Viking Festival. And, you know, you have all the pirate festivals now. You know, there's a Dickens Festival, run by the son of Ron, Phyllis Patterson, up in Northern California. So I just love all the little, the riffs on all the themes. It's not having to keep it in Renaissance, but trying different kinds of, there's a fairy festival up there in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be very, very nice. So, you know, I love all the riffing on the themes. But they were very stickler, like, this is Renaissance, and the people who worked there could not dress as a pirate. Because
mm-hmm.
it would just be like, you're not Renaissance. So I kind of, there was something a little fascist about it, but I kind of like that.
Well, you definitely have. How did you come across some of these old films? Now, you interviewed a lot of the people that were very.
Well, that's what I did. I asked those people if they had filmed, and they started, you know, kind of put the word out, and they started dumping, you know, the VHS tapes or even 8mm and 16mm film.
Oh, my goodness.
From the 70s. And they didn't have any way to play it, but I got it all transferred for them and able to be used in the documentary. So I had all these kind of, you know, photos and videos, and it took me a long time to sort out what was what. If I run, you know, the videos from the 80s, obviously, I personally love the 70s 8mm and 16mm film from the 70s. You really get a sense of the kind of party it was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the wild party it was. It may not be that wild today, but any good counterculture has a wild party, I think. I don't know why, but I just think that might be part of the counterculture.
Well, I think it might be to a degree. One of the points that came out in your film that I thought was so significant, because I've seen it here at the Ren Fair, is the wonderful family associations that are developed. There are young people that come into it, and their children grew up with all of the activities. Everybody sort of looked out for everybody else. And I know here in the state of Washington, with the fair that goes mm-hmm. on here, and that's starting up in August, that is a big thing. This is like one huge family. If someone gets sick or something happens, these people interact with each other, and when one of them passes away, it just really is very deeply felt by the people that put on this event. And I'm just really pleased to see all of the commentary that you have in your film about what worked in and the filming of, like, the bear wrestler that you have. Now, this wasn't a gigantic bear. It wasn't a grizzly. But it was something that created the facade, the illusion, and the animal wasn't
right.
in any way negatively used. It's amazing.
That was... Yeah, that was one of the Gary Morgan, one of the people we interviewed in the documentary, is a stuntman, a Hollywood
mm-hmm.
stuntman, and he's hilarious. Anyway, he did give us some 8mm footage from the 70s, and I'm looking at his footage, and there's like there he is wrestling a bear, and then I believe I put it over this line where you could get away with stuff in the 60s and 70s that you would never get away with today. And then
that's true. That
shot,
is absolutely true.
Put the shot of him wrestling the bear on there. It was just outrageous. So he's quite an animal lover, though. He's got all sorts of animals. It's pretty impressive. But, yes, there is a bear wrestling. They are all a family at the Renaissance Fair. Those people kind of grew up together, and then they
mm-hmm.
had kids, and those kids kind of know each other from the fair, and they grew up together. And I think I see this a lot, not just in Renaissance Fair, but going on a lot these days, where people are sort of mainstream media or mainstream, the idea of mainstream is sort of on a slow decline, and people are sort of finding themselves in community subcultures. And that could be soapbox racing, or it could be, you know, roller derby, or it could be the Renaissance Fair. But they're all kind of finding themselves in these subcultures, and I find that very interesting as things kind of go forward.
Now, you have Marilyn here, and this gentleman that plays Marilyn in the Renaissance Fair, the master magician that all of us know, was the support of King Arthur. And
Merlin,
when you look at what you have put together in the film and you're talking with these different people, I really think that it shows the ingenuity of individuals and how they just thrive on being able to step into these different roles to be able to escape, you might say, the modern-day harshness. I know the people that attend these Ren Fairs come away, it's like they're mentally refreshed, just totally refreshed. They may be walking around with a turkey leg in one hand and a root beer in the other, but they're just having a wonderful, wonderful time. And that is something that your commentary and your documentary brings across again and again and again. It allows people to challenge themselves creatively and to be able to just go into a space of thinking where they don't have to worry about a pinstripe suit and or wearing, you know, tight pantyhose to make sure that their stomach is flat when they have on a, you know, an outfit. I mean, this is really okay. It is really all right. And the kids thrive in it. That's what I just love
about
the whole thing.
They do.
People
like to dress up and go out. I mean, you know, Halloween is one of the most, you know, sort of popular holidays. And why is that? Because people like to play roles. They like to go out and, you know, be someone other than themselves. And kids get this faster than adults do. And I think that the kids, you know, love playing in the playground. You know, I'm sure there's pluses and minuses to both. But, you know, a lot of the kids who grew up at the fair that I talked to, you know, it was a positive experience of their growing up. They really got a little bit street smarts, too, off the whole thing. I mean, and one of the guys, Gary, had his kids, and he was teaching them early hustles, you know, how to, like, do puppet shows or get money or, you know.
How to work. Because when you think of the Renaissance, when you think of the Renaissance period, life was very tough. There was nothing glamorous about the Renaissance unless you were of the upper class and you wanted to use the term glamorous, which to me is a far stretch. But that was a time when art started coming back. We were coming out of the Dark Ages, severe oppression. Mm-hmm. So now you had this other flavor. But the kids, one of the things that I found that is really encouraged is that the kids are taught that there is business, there are things that you have to do, and you have to be responsible. So if they work with a merchant, and I was amazed to see how many children, whether they were 8 or 9 years old or they were teenagers, if somebody needed help, they'd say, okay, and it was all encouraged. That level of personal responsibility really came across loudly and clearly, and I still see that today, which I think is fabulous.
That's great. That's great. I mean, things are changing and morphing and, you know, and what we're doing is the conversation, obviously this documentary does kind of take you through the Renaissance Fair with sort of the California Renaissance Fair and how it kind of rose and then a little bit of a kind of a decline. You know, in Southern California, there's a lot of distractions for things to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Magic Mountain, Disneyland, Knott's Berry Farm, you have there's a lot of stuff here. So the fairs here do well, but they don't do as well as fairs in other parts of the country. And a lot of other people all over the country had, you know, their commentary about where a fair is and where it's going and all this stuff. So what we're starting to do is we're starting to let people videotape themselves, interview themselves, and we're putting this together, so we're almost there. We're putting together how people can do this, and send in their video clips, and we're cutting together like a little crowdsourced documentary where people can tell us their thoughts on all these topics from all over the country.
Now, one of the things that you brought out,
a little experimental.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the late 60s, and I know we've got a little bit of a time delay in our communication, so I'm sorry that that's happening, but one of the points for economics, because most of the people in these fairs are entrepreneurs, most of the participants.
Yeah.
Now, they might have a regular day job, but most of them are of the entrepreneurial temperament. And in the 60s,
yeah,
you said the fairs at that time gave the artists an outlet so they could sell their craft, and that is big. People, I know,
yeah,
here in Washington, we find that people absolutely love knowing about the women that do the tatting or make the hats or make costumes, or men and women that do special wood crafting. And you're able to watch them do it while you're there.
Yeah.
And making of masks and all kinds of things. So in the 60s, and again, this is a documentary regarding the evolution of the Renaissance Fair and the theme, and they're all over the country. You have a map in this documentary that has flags showing every part of the country, just about, has something on this order that people are just saying, we want more of this. And I really think that this gives the opportunity for the artisan to say, come and see what I do, get to know me, you can sit down and you can talk to me, whether it's the making of candles, stained glass windows, glass blowing, making armor for the knights, and because up here in Washington we have the jousting knights, or you have the weavers that do all of their things, the people that make jewelry. I mean, it's incredible. All of these wonderful talents, art of all genres. It's just marvelous.
It is. The handcrafted movement, people making their craft in the booth and selling their craft in the booth, you know, is something that is sort of always under attack, you know. It's sort of something that, you know, people, it's good to go to a place where you can see stuff you can't buy anywhere else. It wasn't manufactured in China, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see this person physically making your jewelry for you, or your, you know, you can buy stained glass, wonderful stained glass windows at the Renaissance fairs and those other kinds of affairs. There is a constant battle between the people who are bringing in imports, as they call them, and the handcrafted people. And, you know, that's, I think that's a struggle for the handcrafted people, as they've told me. I mean, I wasn't aware, but they've been saying that, you know, it's tough. It's tough making a living because you spend all this time making this stuff and you can't be as cheap as a Chinese imported product. And so there is this kind of battle between that. But it's still good to know that you can go to these festivals and find some really nice handcrafted stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that people should be aware that go with a little extra money with the intention of, you know, maybe have one less beer, but go get a, they have all these, you know, they usually sell the, like, tchotchke type stuff, but then they sell the, you know, nice stuff, especially the armor, the swords, some of the dressmakers and clothing makers,
mm-hmm,
there are incredible. So
they really,
good to hear
really
that
are.
And what is your character at the fair, if you have one?
Oh, I am a lady, yeah, of a royal house. I'm Lady Donna.
Okay.
I'm Lady Donna, and I do psychic readings for people when I'm there.
Oh, really? You said that you're,
yeah,
you set up a... Wow.
I set up a booth, and I have big yellow banners with red lions on them. And so it is something that I just thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy. And it has been an event, no matter where you are in the country, if you have a chance to go to this, it's absolutely awesome. But more than that, if you like history, and if you'd be interested in seeing how what we might take for granted in areas, I know Colorado, Denver, Colorado has a huge Renaissance fair, and
right,
California's got them, but they're all over the country. And if it's small or if it's large, it's something that isn't a family event, it's a family environment. And I would say support your community, support wherever you are, because it's worth it. But this film that has won a number of awards and points of recognition because of the historical data it has of the films that he's been able to get. It's called Fair, an American Renaissance. What's your website, Doug?
Our website is fairdocumentary.com, F-A-R-E. F-A-I-R-E, sorry, my brain. Fairdocumentary.com. We are in the process of chatting with a bunch of distributors right now, and we are going to, that should work itself out in the next couple months. But we've been selling this doc initially, because we're still talking to distributors, to Renaissance Fairs and Renaissance Fair participants and people. And so our sales agent said, well, don't sell it on the site, sell it. As long as your listeners don't tell anyone, sell it on the, you can sell it somewhere else, but just so the distributors, when you're trying to get a distributor, you don't want to be selling it because the distributor goes, all right, it's already for sale. They don't really usually care. But anyway, we have a Facebook page, we have a website, and I have a special merchant site where anyone can buy the doc right now at therenfair.com, therenfaire. And that's just a site we set up for merchants and people at the Renaissance Fairs. We feel we're going to give them, anyone can buy it from there, but we wanted to get booth owners and people at the fair and fairs themselves selling them first before we go out on the general public. But I tell people they can buy it at that website as well. It's for the, even though it's for the merchants.
I think that this is just great. I know we're out of time, but for those of you listening, if you want to see famous movie stars where they were taking, when they were very young and were taking their families to the Ren Fair, you want to see some history, all because of one woman's concept idea, Phyllis Patterson. Her husband supported her in it, and bless her soul, she had no idea it was going to take off and evolve as it has. But it's a wonderful film, Fair, an American Renaissance. It started in the U.S., and it's absolutely great. And, Doug, I want to thank you for being my guest. Go to their website, Fair, F-A-I-R-E, documentary.com, and then also the Ren Fair, R-E-N, the T-R-E-N-F-A-I-R-E.com, and you'll find more information about it. It is wonderful. It's wonderful to watch. This is Donna Sebo. Thanks again, Doug, for being with me. We're taking a break. We're
going to
be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Welcome, my lords and ladies, to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, located at Marist Farms in Buckley, Washington. For 3 weekends in August, starting August 7th and 8th, we will transport you back to the days of old, where magic and merriment reigned. Come see the multitude of musicians, dancers, jugglers, gypsies, peasants, nobles, pirates, and prestidigitation. That's magic for you commoners. Learn to swing a sword or shoot a bow and be knighted by Her Majesty the Queen. Hold your breath as jousters wheel their mounts around to engage in full contact combat on the field of battle. Sign on to sail the seas with scurvy pirates, or sit down with friends and family for turkey legs and a fine brewed ale. Delights abound for the young and old at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, so come one and all, starting August 7th and 8th, for fun and excitement, and may your day be fair. For tickets and info, go to www.washingtonfair.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Telephone number to call into, toll-free worldwide, is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, you've just heard the ad. We've been talking about the Renaissance Fair and how it evolved. But here in Washington, because we've got ours coming up the 1st of August, the first 3 weekends of August it's available, I do have free passes. So I want you to give me a call. I have some left, and you will have them, and why not? This is a marvelous event. So if you're listening in Washington and you'd like to take yourself, your family, friends perhaps, give me a call. Call me at my office, 800-872-8852, and we'll get them in the mail to you. 2 weeks, it's going to be starting up. So give me a call if you would like. I have a few passes left, and you have a chance for it. Otherwise, send me an email. Send an email to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com, and we will need your contact information so that we can get those tickets out to you. It is absolutely a marvelous, marvelous event to participate in. I'm so pleased to be involved in it again, but also for the entire family. There's just so much to see and do. So I invite you to get those free passes. By the way, the pass, and this is out at the Maris Farm in Buckley, the pass is for 2 adults and 2 children. So it's a nice thing to have. And maybe you'd want to gift it to a friend. If you're not able to do it, then we have something here you could gift to a friend if you wanted to do so. Donna Siebel here, 888-815-9756. Now, I'm going to have a recipe I want to share with you. There is a big to-do that I'm going to be involved with and a salad that I absolutely love. If you're going to have vegetarians at a party, one of the best things you could serve for summer, in my personal opinion, is a salad called tabbouleh. Now, this is a very popular Middle Eastern salad, and the flavors are awesome. So I'm going to be sharing that recipe with you, so have a pad of paper and pen handy if you'd like to copy it down, because it is so easy to make, but the flavors are absolutely terrific. Well, let me just share with you. And again, if you want to call in and chat with me, 888-815-9756. If you're something, anything like me, when summertime comes along, you like to go to your local farmer's market because you're going to have your local produce, which usually is vine ripened, and it just has a marvelous flavor, whether it is zucchini or it is tomatoes. And I had a poem that I came across with a picture of someone's garden of all these fresh vegetables, you know, squash, summer squash, tomatoes, and peppers, and just it's absolutely marvelous what the way the food tastes when you have your own garden. But again, from your local farmers, if you're like me, you have about as much time for gardening as you do for doing a 500-mile marathon. It just isn't going to happen. Well, this is a poem by Elna Rabb that I really like. She says, "Verdant garden brimming over, earth between my fingertips, a wicker basket harvest of carrots and lettuce and juicy tomatoes, all the makings of the perfect salad fresh from the soil of summer." I think that that is so true. And my compliments to those of you who are avid gardeners. That I am not. I don't have time for it. But for those of you that do, my goodness, I know how much you enjoy the delicious fruits and vegetables of labor that you've put in and love to make your gardens grow. And I just think it is marvelous. So, again, I'll be sharing a recipe with you in a little bit. But I wanted to also, because if you're cooking in certain areas, we're finally thawing out here in Washington. Maybe I should say we're drying out. But usually it gets, for us, when it gets up into the 70s and close to 80, we really think it's warm. Now, I know there's lots of you, if you're in Vegas, it's about 112 to 115. That is really perking as far as I'm concerned. Well, when it gets really hot, you like to have something to drink that's going to be refreshing. And one of the things I have found that's really worked for us for years is on a hot day, we love to have sun-brewed tea, and we take fresh mint out of our garden. And believe me, this is a tiny garden session, but the mint grows forever. I mean, it'll take over your garden if you're not careful. But you just take a mint leaf, roll it between your fingers a little bit, and drop it in your tea. And it just is absolutely, wonderfully refreshing. refreshing. It just makes a great deal. But you can also do some other things. And these are ideas that people shared that I thought, hey, this is a pretty good thing to do. Cucumber. Now, you do this in a blender. You take a half of a peeled cucumber. Remember, it has to be peeled. And you take the juice of one lime, put in 5 mint leaves. They like to add 3 teaspoons of sugar. For me, I'd add some stevia. And you add an ounce of water with a half a cup of ice. You turn on your blender and then add a little bit of sparkling water, or if you like, 7-Up. Very, very refreshing. And it has a taste unlike anything you've ever had before, but it's not overwhelming. It's light, it's refreshing, and it's cooling. And then another thing to do is to take pink grapefruit juice. And it's like 4 ounces of pink grapefruit juice and 4 ounces of cranberry juice. Put that in a glass, add crushed ice, then stir, and then top with 2 ounces of a grapefruit soda and garnish it with a lime wedge. Very, very refreshing. And I'm sure you've got some ideas yourself, but you've got to remember, when it's warm, you have to hydrate. Now, I'm going to share a tip with you that I learned a while back. If you're going to be out, and this is very important even if you have children, keeping yourself hydrated is extremely significant, especially if you are in outdoor activities. Let's say you go to a Ren Fair, and it's really, really hot, which has happened here in Washington. And by golly, people were passing out because they had to have medics come in. So you have to stay hydrated. And the best way to do it, have plain water, add a little bit of sugar and salt to your water. You know, an IV that you get at a hospital, that's what it has in it. It has sugar and salt in it because those are components you absolutely need. Pickles, if you're going to be in an outdoor activity, dill pickles, sour pickles, great. Why? One, they've got a lot of liquid in them. Two, they have salt in them, and that's very good for you. It really, really is. Sometimes people are not aware of how something so simple as a glass of water with a little bit of sugar and a little bit of salt in it will hydrate the body immediately. And it is just something to keep in mind. And that's a very, very simple thing to do. If you have anyone that you notice is dehydrated, that will put them back into shape and nothing flat. If you know someone that's going through a hypoglycemic situation, get them that sugar water with a little bit of salt. It'll turn them around immediately. The same with a diabetic. It is really good. It is simple. It's easy. And it, again, you're going to be outside. You're going to be in that hot temperature. You want to make sure you do for yourself what you need to do. It doesn't take a whole bunch. A little bit goes a long way. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I like talking about studies because there are so many different paradigms that people like to explore. And you know, I am an animal fan and I thoroughly enjoy cats and dogs, but I had no idea that people decided to investigate whether there was a difference between a dog person, a cat person. Well, I think they're an animal lover. That was never a big deal to me. However, there was a Sam Gosling, and he said he decided he really wanted to go further. So I wanted to share this with you. If you're a dog person, if that is your favorite pet, you're very conscientious as a person, and you seem to be more extroverted. Why? Because your animal, your dog, has to be walked, bathed, and played with, and it demands sociability and superior organizational skills. Boy, with my schedule, I can attest to that with 2 Scottish Terriers. And you're also likely to show leadership potential, and you like being the pack leader. Of course, if you are the owner of the dog, you are supposed to be the leader of the pack. If the dog itself is the pack leader, I think you're going to have a problem. But anyway, you really enjoy being that person that is a take-charge type of an individual. Now, what if you love cats? Well, you've got an openness and a willingness to embrace new ideas. That's right. You like kitties because they are independent and they have minds of their own. You're a deep thinker. Now, they did find that cat people, they found that cat people were sometimes a little neurotic. Well, I'll tell you what. You're actually okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But they said it means you are vigilant and you are hyper aware about things that are going on and you have a deep curiosity. New ideas, Sam found in his research, are like catnip to you. Now, I've got a little bit more to share with you because if you love dogs and cats, there's something for that. But if you don't really have a preference, you're neither a dog person or a cat person, well, guess what? We've even got some insight on you. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, you're going to find out a little bit more, and I'm going to share that recipe for tabbouleh with you as well. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to have me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-815-9756.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
All right, let me finish up with a dog and cat situation. Now, if you love dogs and cats, you know what? You're creative. That's right. And you represent, when you love both of these animals, polar opposites. On one end is a subconscious association with contemplation and mysteriousness. And on the other end is frolic, fun. That's what you enjoy. And you really don't have a lot of preconceived notions about life. You keep an open mind about many, many things. And you find that you can work with unique ideas, connecting them to perhaps possibilities for major accomplishments. So if you love both dogs and cats, you're going to find that you're a very adaptive and creative person. Now, what if you're not a dog or a cat person? What if you're someone that likes other animals, but you just really are your own soul, you might say? Well, you're very independent. You know, if you were neither a dog or a cat person, they said when we did the report, we thought it meant that you weren't going to be too agreeable, but they found the people that don't try to make a preference, usually are quite sociable, and you don't hate the animals. You just, you know, it's like, okay, I like them if they're there. If they're not there, that's okay. And you do things your own way. And it's just that independent streak within you. So that all came from a study by Sam Gosling. And fun things like this always make for good conversation. Well, we're coming up right now with the recipe for tabbouleh. I first became acquainted with this many years ago when, in a past life, I was married to a Syrian Armenian. And I had had no real interaction with very much of Middle Eastern food until I really got to know my mentor, which was years later, it was a year or two after I was in this marriage. And then I really got into Middle Eastern cuisine. But I had found out about this salad called tabbouleh, and it is a staple in many family homes in the Middle East because it is very refreshing, it's very easy to make, and the flavors, I think, are really, really good. So here we go. You need a package. It's 5 1/4 ounces of your tabbouleh wheat, and it is a particular kind of wheat grain, so it's something that absorbs flavors very, very well. You're going to need a cup of boiling water, one lemon, one cucumber. Oh, be sure you wash your lemon and your cucumber thoroughly. One lemon, one cucumber, and a cup of grape tomatoes. You can use regular tomatoes if you like, but you need a cup of tomatoes. A third of a cup of olive oil and vinegar dressing, and you can make your own. Whatever is your favorite, use that. 1/4 cup of pitted Kalamata olives, and you want to cut them in half. And then if you like a bit of onion, you can take one scallion, chop that up real fine, the green as well, along with the white of the scallion. Then you need 1 tablespoon of fresh mint, and you want to chop it up, and you want to make it fine. You don't want to have a huge chunk because the finer cut is going to blend better with the salad. And you need 1 tablespoon of chopped fresh basil, and the fresh really makes a difference. The times that I fix tabbouleh with the dried mint, you may need a little bit more of that, but it's not quite the same. The fresh really does give a distinctive difference in the salad. You need 1/4 teaspoon of pepper, and then if you would like, you can have 1/2 cup of crumbled feta cheese. Well, what I would say is this is so easy, and this can be fixed up so quickly. It's great for summer. In a large bowl, you put your bulgur wheat, your tabbouleh wheat, and your boiling water. You want to put that in. Now, in the box that you get, you're going to find there might be a spice packet. You can toss that in, you know, toss the spices they have in the box itself in. And you just want to stir the wheat up, and it'll sink to the bottom of your bowl, and this water will be on top of it. Well, you cover that, and you stick it in the refrigerator. And you'll find that the wheat is going to soak up every drop of water. It's going to get nice and soft and very plump. Now, what you do on the side, you grate 1 teaspoon of zest and squeeze 1 tablespoon of juice from your lemon. And you want to have a large serving bowl when you do this. You're going to put in your cucumber. Your cucumber, I'd recommend that you peel, because sometimes the cucumber skins can be rather tight. And you can try different cucumbers. If you want English cucumbers or your all-American cucumber, whatever your preference is, don't be afraid to do that. But it should be peeled, and I think taking the seeds out makes it nice. And then mince the cucumber up. And then you're going to need 1 cup of your tomatoes. And if you use grape tomatoes, cut them in half. And if you use regular tomatoes, cut them up any way you want. And then you add your olives, the dressing, your onion, your mint, your basil, your pepper. You mix it all together in that big bowl, and then you toss all of this with your wheat salad mixture after it has been refrigerated for a while. And then your feta cheese, you can serve that on the side. Some people like it, some people don't, but it adds a nice, if you have a good feta cheese, it adds a nice bite of flavor to this salad. Pita bread goes great with this. And I think you'll find that your Middle Eastern foods have a lot of flavor and texture in them. And they are just wonderful, especially on hot summer days. And that's not a surprise. I mean, they live in very hot climates. But it's a very refreshing salad, very tasty, and it's a nice complement to any grilled meats you might be fixing. And if you're having vegetarians over, that along with grilled vegetables, makes a wonderful, wonderful setting for a meal. Also, quick flash for a dessert. Now, this is not something that Super Colossal knew, but a friend of mine did this when we were putting together a party real quick, and that is to buy cookies like your vanilla wafers and put ice cream between them. And whatever size cookie you get, if it's like the circular size of, you know, of an Oreo or something like that, but you want a simple plain cookie, and then you just put ice cream between it, wrap it, put it in the freezer, and if you get the bite-sized ones, they're great to serve at parties. Real fast, real easy, and you're going to be a hit. Just a simple, simple dessert to use. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how to know if it's time to go. We're talking about relationships, not a funeral. And I think you will find a lot of wisdom here. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. We'll be talking with you same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.